All right, so this is called the afterburn. Let me just mark off what I finished here. There we go. This is called the afterburn. If you have comments or questions or thoughts you'd like to share about today's teaching, you can come up and line up over here. If you're online, our Shamash team will take down your comments and questions and read them over the microphone. All right, we'll begin with, shockingly, Shamash Steve.
Okay, well, Janet's not here, so... Okay, you talked about showing partiality, and I think if we're true to ourselves, all of us act in partiality depending on what it is through our daily lives. So what's a good tool for us to discover what's actually discriminatory and judging, and then what's judgment? Judgment, making good judgment, which will affect our partiality.
All right, so... I think we've talked about this, not as much lately, but I think we talked about it a lot going back a year or two. The idea of, to successfully make this journey, one of the greatest tools you can have is a heightened self-awareness, okay? A heightened self-awareness, which means that you're now aware of your preferences. You're aware when something comes up and you're like, I don't like that. I don't want to do that, especially aware that it's something you know you should do, but you don't want to. I'm not saying the awareness that I don't want that and really something you shouldn't do, but you need to be aware of which one is going on. Watch yourself, monitor yourself, because the partiality is there if you look for it, if you pay attention to it. The things you're so strong about, and look and notice whether or not you're strong about everything else similar to that. Or are you only strong about that or two or three things? Because usually people are strong about more than one, but not more than two or three. The other stuff, they kind of have some strength, but not really. And there's other things they're completely weak on or don't do at all. And so that's where it all comes down to, Steve, is you have to get that heightened awareness of self. Okay? I actually think I called it hyper-vigilantly aware. Okay? You have to be vigilant in your awareness of yourself. Always be watching yourself. And then notice, should I be saying what I just said? Should I be doing what I just did? Is there something I'm supposed to be doing that I'm not doing that I'm trying to avoid? I'm getting in somebody's face about something of Torah. Do I feel the same way about all the Torah? Is there something they could get in my face about that I'm not doing? And just kind of be aware of yourself. Okay, Craig.
And what you were just saying there in the start of James about really looking at ourselves and not showing partiality, I think it's easier, or it has been easy. I've actually been reading and studying the book of Yaakov again. But the not showing partiality, it's easy to find an area where you can point to a group of people and say, they're not doing this. They're not doing, but if you read James enough, you're going to find that there's plenty of areas where you're not doing something that he states just as heavily and as hard. Mm-hmm. So the hyper focus has got to be to there's scripture that talks about covering a sin, or... how do we always have that ability to overlook what I see in you, but the ability to then turn that? I think the only way to handle that is to in turn and to take that onto myself and only focus on the areas where I can become what Yaakov is talking about. Mm-hmm. It's certainly, I think that I hear it a lot. Well, we'll be praying for you. And I think maybe that I do that as well when I could give what they need, which Yaakov talks about as well. And he talks about so much throughout this. Is, do we be brash with people that are, you can just tell when somebody is saying that's, I'll pray for you. And they're really either not going to pray for you, or their prayer isn't necessarily what you need, or is it? How do we handle that with amongst the brethren? Because there's other areas where I need it to be as hard, where I'm not listening as well. It seems like in the book of Yaakov, it covers so much of that.
Okay, all right. So I think what we need is to kind of reset the parable with the twig and the plank. See, what it's really talking about there is the plank in your own eye is your own problem. That's something you should be working on. The twig in your brother's eye, it's not saying you've got something so big that you don't have time necessarily for the twig. The twig's not your problem. It's his problem. And yours is big enough that it should keep you occupied. You don't need to worry about other people's problems. And that's kind of the essence that comes into this, is that, you know, if somebody says, I'll pray for you, I hope they do, or I hope it's something as long as they're not doing it right then, I don't know what they're going to do. I'll just say, thank you, I appreciate that, and that's it. I'm not going to say, hey, you should do it now or anything else. But I, for my own twig or my own plank, I would be pushing myself, if I catch myself saying, no, I'll do it right now. Okay, let me pray with you now. Now, bear in mind, this is not, I'm going to get away from the Christianized side of this. This is only when it's asked of me, or because of my position, I feel that's the thing that's needed at the moment. But amongst brethren, I wouldn't impose, I'm going to pray for you. Let me pray for you. I'm going to come on. Let me pray for you. Because that gets awkward and weird. Anybody have had that happen? Okay? So don't bring that into the mix. What I'm saying is, if a person says, could you pray for me? I'm really going through something. I just want to ask if you would pray for me. So then would you like me to do it now? Ask them, by the way, because maybe they don't want you to do it now. Maybe they're a little concerned about what you might say. But then if they say, it'll bless them if they want it. And they'll say, yes. And then you do it right then. And they can hear your heart for them right there. Okay? But Craig brought up a really good point. I mean, this is one of those deals. And it just hopefully we can get the idea of understanding it's about us being overly focused outside instead of inside. Okay? Because we're now trying to impose. When we were adamant about certain beliefs and we see someone's not doing it, we feel it's our job to get involved. Outside is about being aware of a need. The person's hungry, the person's thirsty, they need help with something. So we should always be looking outside for needs. They don't need you to straighten them out. It's not your job. Okay? Abba will straighten them out, or they'll send them to somebody like me who will straighten them out. That's the person who has the job. It's not your job. Then don't do the job. That's not your job. Because then it's coming from a wrong motivation. Because it's actually personally bothering you that someone's doing what you think is wrong. It's not about you. It's about him. Okay? Okay, Ashley.
First of all, I want to apologize for falling asleep. I didn't get much sleep last night, so...
I didn't notice.
Mike said I started snoring, so... You have impeccable timing with this. I wanted to ask you, for verse 14, having girded your waist with the truth and having put on the breastplate of righteousness, since you talked about this a couple months ago, I'm going to be really vulnerable here because I need all the counseling I can get. What could I have done? I know what I started the trigger this time. What could I have done with verse 14 a couple days ago?
All right. Look, the truth, okay, is what sets you free, right? Knowing it, having a relationship with it. So what you experience, without exposing everything to everybody, is that you, without actually being in, came into something that had contact with and reminded you of a world that you used to be in, okay? The truth is you're not in that world. As a matter of fact, all the people involved in that world aren't even in that world anymore. They're dead or they're whatever. They've moved on. So that whole thing doesn't exist at the moment. But it existed in a real way when you were younger, okay? And you were dealing with some very challenging things back then. And so what you experienced was that your life came into close proximity with things that are very strongly reminded of that world, okay? And that reminder triggered. But what triggered wasn't real. In other words, it's not actually happening now. It doesn't exist now. It was real what happened, but what triggered is you responded as if it's still happening now. Okay.
The memories are that strong. The memories are really that strong.
The memories are that strong. So what the cure is, you have to bring in the truth. The truth is that did happen, but it's not happening now. Things are different now. The people that were doing these things are not here. Okay, all of these things are no longer the same, and so that reality can help to give you that pulling out of that memory that you fell into and bring you back into the real world, okay?
Okay.
Because you were reliving the memory.
And then two more questions on this, and I apologize, but the being in that world or whatever you want to call it in my head. Especially this morning, I could hear both sides, feel both sides, whatever you want to call it. And I was literally yelling, shut up, to the wrong side. And
those don't count, Billy, don't count. She said it, not me. Okay.
Shush it, shush it, shush it, shush it.
Oh, whatever.
And, but, like, why is it a weakness? Am I weak or am I just not, do I not have enough immunity yet or do I have
none? No. Look, really traumatic things, okay, don't generally resolve themselves without somebody guiding you through it. That's why we go to therapy. Okay, we get therapy because there's a person who can guide us through how to process and then repackage and put in a safe place, a memory, so that it's still useful and that you remember it so you can learn from it, but it doesn't suck you back into it. Okay, because basically you like time warped into this place where you were right back where you were back then.
Yeah.
And so that's where you need somebody professional to help you repackage that, so that it can be put in a little box in the back of your mind someplace where, if needed, it's there, but it doesn't just pop up anywhere all by itself.
Okay.
Okay?
My last question is, are you going to talk more about the Helmet of Deliverance?
No.
Or is that much today?
That was it.
Okay.
Okay, because you're focusing more on wanting to hear about deliverance. This is not about deliverance. It was about defending the mind. Okay? But deliverance is a whole nother teaching.
Okay.
Okay? Ms. Shira.
I would greatly appreciate your kind comments on two things, if you'll bear with me, right at the beginning and right at the end. So in the beginning, you were talking about the mechanics of belief and how this shield of faith is protecting our set-apart position. And you had some really great comments about parents disciplining their children and exercising so much more effort and even strictness with the ones who have expressed and demonstrated that they really want to change and they really want to grow.
Right.
So,
By the way, I just want to interrupt. If you are doing a skilled thing, music, art, something physical, like a sport or anything like that, you know who the coach is hardest on or the teacher's hardest on? The one that has the most talent. The ones that are really not that talented and really don't put in any effort and really not trying that hard don't get the attention, because it's a waste to put too much attention into a person who doesn't care enough to really put it in. The ones, when I say talented, I don't mean just like natural. The ones who are working at it, who care about it, they may think, man, the teacher hates me. No, the teacher loves you. Okay? My daughter had to learn that because of all of her talents. And when I first had her leading the praise team, you know, sometimes she was like, Dad, you're so hard on me. I said, no, I'm hard. Not because she thought it because I didn't love her and I didn't think she was talented. I said, no, it's because you're so capable and I'm trying to get you to that highest possible level and encourage you up there. But that's the same. So it can be in any kind of a mode. But if someone is being really tough on you, who's instructing you, first thing you should be thinking, I must have a lot of potential. If Abba's being really tough on you, you must think, I have a lot of potential. That's a good thought right there. Okay, and by the way, when I was working with Ashley, did you notice the tone of voice? Did you notice how this is what you get in counseling when it's necessary. See, some of you don't understand that, so you don't come in counsel, but see, that was like a counsel session. Okay, and so you get to see the tone of voice and the gentleness that's there. All right, continue.
Thank you. So what came to my mind was that the writer of Hebrews in chapter 12, this is a passage about disciplining the sons, how Elohim disciplines his sons. And boy, this is stronger language than I even heard you use. I mean, Elohim, it's like if you don't get flogged, you're not a real son.
Yep.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments further on that? Because, I mean, that really would relate to somebody who's just unmotivated about changing.
Look, he knows. Well, first of all, I'll just say it this way. He knows the potential all of you have. And so he's going to do everything he can to motivate you to get there. And it won't necessarily be pleasant. I always talk about there's a plan A and a plan B. Plan A is figure it out and do it yourself, meaning just do what he says and trust him. Plan B is don't do it yourself and don't trust him, and he's going to smack you around until you realize I better start trusting him. Now, as far as the harshness, I'm glad you pointed out, because I have claimed, I suppose, that I am discipled from above and that I'm trying to represent that above as best I can. And you see, he sounds, or I sound like him. He sounds like me. He doesn't just say, oh, well, you're going to be all wonderful and everything's great. No, he says, look, if I love you, I'm going to chasten all those I love, and I might even flog you and beat you down. By the way, curse you seven times. If that doesn't work, curse you seven times more. If that doesn't work, curse you seven times more. Oh, no, that's where you get this bipolar God, the Old Testament one who was all harsh and mean, and the New Testament one who just loves everybody and came out of the 60s. Okay? I think he grew up in Haight-Ashbury or something. All right? So I'm just saying that's the craziness of what the world has done with what's going on in this book. Instead of recognizing you have love all the way through. Okay? And what does he do to those that actually listen? It's awesome. It's blessed. Everything goes great. It's only the stubborn who don't want to listen that end up getting smacked around until they get their attention enough to say, are you ready to listen now? If you're a parent, you probably have had at least one child. If you had only one child, I don't know. But if you had more than one child, you've had at least a moment where you looked at that child after smacking them around a little bit. I don't even mean literally. Where life is smacking them around. And you go, you ready to listen now? Have you ever said it to a child? Are you ready to listen now? Because that's the problem. Life's going to keep kicking them and punching them and beating them up till they're ready to listen. I don't necessarily mean physically, although it could be. But emotionally, at the least, and things not going right because he's going to get your attention one way or the other. All right, go ahead.
I appreciated then at the end when you talked briefly about the helmet that the deliverance is the defense. That is awesome. That helps me understand that so much better. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So we got to defend our mind, and you said it all starts with the mind. And I'm going, yeah. The mind is the battlefield. The mind's the hardest, just about the hardest thing to conquer, and he puts it last. So I'm wondering, just as in 2 Peter chapter 1, he has a progression of developing, you know, your brotherly love and your affection. You know, he goes in a certain order. Is there possibly an order that, are these things, these pieces of armor building on each other? And so actually would it be that in order to actually start reaping the benefits of conquering the mind, we have to start with the belt of truth, the breastplate of righteousness? Do these build on each other?
I mean, I have to look and see if it actually works that way. I think what happened is he used the order with which people put armor on. That's how, because you put the helmet on last, and then you pick, actually the sword is last, but you put the helmet on and then you pick up your sword. So you start off at the beginning by putting on the girding your waist and putting on the breastplate. This is how they put armor on you. So I think he used the order with which armor was put on. I think that doesn't mean you can't have this building thing working. I'd have to look at it and see if that does work. But I think it's really the order at the end. And the last thing really is then you pick up your sword. Your armor's all on, your helmet's on, now you got your sword. Because they put the helmet on last before picking up the weapon, and then they're ready to go. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Maybe none of you really thought about it that way, but if you think about how they put armor on, if you ever watched a movie where someone was getting the armor put on, they put their waist on first, and they put the breastplate on, and then they do everything in the same order right here. Jennifer.
Okay, so I have one question, but I feel like I'm going to go around the loop a little bit. But so I've been in this walk for just like 2 years, so still like a newbie. But, you know, you were talking about like how there's things that people are really passionate about, like maybe certain commandments or whatever. For me, there's things that like I knew right away when my bubble was popped, like, yes, this is true. Shabbat, you know, I'm going to keep the Shabbat. I'm going to, you know, eventually kosher eating became important, like all these things. Right. Mm-hmm. But like, how do we, how do we create a desire to please Abba first in every way, like in every area? I don't know if I'm wording this right, but like what I noticed. So last night at the Torah study, I had a thought. People were sharing, and I thought, those people have a desire to please him first before anything else. Not just about the commandments, like beyond that, they have a desire to please him in everything. And I want that. I want to be doing like a normal daily thing and for it to be my first to desire to be like, would this please Abba?
All right.
So my question is, how do we get that?
Well, why isn't it there?
That's a good question.
It's the answer was in the teaching today, belief. You don't have a belief yet that all of those things are necessary. You have a belief that fixing some of the things are necessary. You have a belief that making an effort on some of the other things is also necessary. But you don't have a belief that everything we do is all about pleasing him. You haven't gotten that core belief in yet. Okay? And so it's a driving belief that makes the difference. You believed that Sunday wasn't the right day and you moved to Saturday. That was a nice mechanical change. You believed you shouldn't eat certain things. And so you changed your diet, right? You went to Leviticus 11. You found out what the difference was there. You found out about holy days and you fixed those things. But even with those things, are you just as meticulous about checking ingredients on a box as you are as what you do on Shabbat or vice versa? Some people decide to get really, you know, very detail focused on one commandment, but not use that same detail focus on all the commandments. And so it has to do with belief on which ones matter or if that they all matter. That's why James is trying to tell us, and John's trying to, I forget which one we were reading, but it said, you know what? If you break one, you break them all. Because they all matter the same. But this partiality thing is where we get in trouble. He said, you have to have that heart to desire Deuteronomy 8, too, that it's in your heart to keep all the commandments. But the heart has to be the same heart. The reason you don't have that yet is because you've been one at a time fixing mistakes that were in there. Oh, I was on the wrong day. I was eating the wrong way. I was keeping the wrong holy days. So you're just fixing these little mistakes. Those mistakes, by the way, were just being someone pointing out you were wrong here. It has nothing to do with your relationship necessarily. You just realize this is the truth. This is the right way. This is the wrong way. So you fixed it. But how you approach them has to do with your relationship. So you're focused more on the mechanics, and now you got to focus more on the relationship that motivates the mechanics. It's because it pleases him when you do. It doesn't please him when you don't. Put him first, okay? And so that's the difference. So you have a belief issue, okay, that you need to figure out how to... Well, you're in my class, right? When you come to the class, I'll give you tools for that, all right? Because it's going to be the same way you fix anything that you're not motivated to do, okay? And so I'll teach you that in the class. Okay, Michael.
I was wondering, because I see that the bit about partiality is about being partial or, you know, towards our treatment of how we apply the commands. But I'm also wondering, is there a way that that applies to people as well? And I'm specifically wondering because I feel like sometimes I might... That I treat my son a little bit differently from I treat my daughter is because he seems to be very much in a bubble pop situation, despite the fact that he's not even six yet. He's almost six. But he gets this stuff. He understands it. He likes to pursue it. He wants to have conversations about it and talk about it. My daughters do not.
Okay, what you have to do, okay, and that may be true. I've interacted with your son, and I think he may... you know, be serious about this. It's hard to know at that age, okay? Because my son seemed pretty into it when he was that age too, and now he's not, so, you know, whatever it is. But the thing is, you have to be able to explain to him, like I had to do with my daughter, why you're doing what you're doing with him different than the girls, okay? And you say, it's because of your relationship with Yahweh and your desire for that relationship that I'm doing these things with you that I don't do with them. Okay, so I'm doing it for you because I know you want to do what's right in his eyes. I'm trying to help you. That changes everything, but you have to explain that to him. Okay?
And then how do I address that situation if it comes up in the future from either of my two daughters? Like, how come you treated us differently? You know what I mean? like, because I don't want them to feel like they're being treated unfairly, but at the same time, equal is not always fair.
No, because, look, what I'm talking about is stuff that would have looked to them like they were getting away with something and he wasn't. So they're not going to complain about that. Okay, if you're giving him extra attention and spoiling him at their expense, then they'd be right and you would be wrong. What I'm saying is, if we're talking about what I talked about, which is he may get a little bit harsher criticism, a little bit stricter attention, they're not ever going to complain about that. Why weren't you harder on us? You know, that's not going to happen. All right?
Okay, thank you, Rabbi.
You're welcome. Okay, the people that complain are the ones who are feeling that they're getting the harder treatment, not the other side. Okay, TJ.
Actually, I just have a comment. I had a praise and I was ashamed, and then I was standing back there with David, and you came across, don't be ashamed. So, and you also told me to be courageous last night. You told us all, I'm not normal to get on the mic or anything. The only reason I was able to do it was because Isaiah asked me to last time, and I was doing it for a member of the Mishpachah. This is for me, and this is really just a big thank you to everyone here. I've never had to ask a question, ever. Never, ever have I had to ask a question because somebody here or online has always beat me to the punch every time. So I just backspace my little comment out, or I sit back and I just listen. Okay, there's the question. So I see people like Isaiah up here and Craig and Brian and all of you guys. You guys are so brave. And I want to be brave like y'all.
Doing a pretty good job right now.
Doing my best. I'm doing my best. So, look, I just want to thank everybody.
Wait, hold on. To come up and be vulnerable is one of the bravest things to do. There are people out there that come up all cocky, this and that, the other thing. That's not brave. You're coming up with overcoming a fear, uncomfortable, you know, all those uncomfortability issues, and you came up anyway, and you're being vulnerable and you're being open. That took courage, and we're very proud of you for that.
Well, thank you. That was it. Thank all of you. Thank all of you.
All right. Amen. Okay, I mean, look, I come up here every week. It takes no bravery whatsoever for me because this is something I'm very comfortable to do. So anytime you go and do something you're not comfortable to do, and you actually do it, you have been courageous. You have been brave, okay? And just know that that's what it is. When you're willing to step outside of your comfort to do what you know you need to do because it needs to get done and you need to go and have that experience of doing it, and you overcame all that and did it anyway, that's when you can get that good little smiley face sticker and say, I was brave, okay? I was brave. All right. Oh, yeah. He said he forgot to mention Michael also as part of the men that he was listing. Okay, Chris.
Okay, so I've had this question before whenever we talk about Abraham, and I want to know if maybe we need more context in where it's coming from is Romans chapter 4, and I guess just a few verses here where it's talking about, it's probably out of context, so I want to know if like this can be understood just from it, or if we need Romans 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, let's not deal with this. I've dealt with this before. Yeah, let's not. This is going to take too long.
Okay.
But I've dealt with it on another teaching. So I know I went through almost all of Romans at one point on some teaching. Does anybody remember what teaching that was? Was it Heart of the Matter? Okay, you'll have to go back and find it. I covered all this, but I know the challenge. Okay. Okay, Mr. Bishop.
Thank you, TJ.
Oh, by the way, I want everybody to take what TJ said, one particular part of it, to heart. If you show up, somebody may ask your question, and you'll get some answers. He got answers not because somebody else asked them, because they could have asked him and he wasn't there. But they asked the questions and he was there, okay? Which is why you want to be at the Zone 2 meetings, Grayson, and you want to make sure you don't miss any of those things. I'm sorry, why are you laughing? He said, you're right. Okay, but you know, you want to be at these places where the Q&As are going on because somebody is very much likely to ask your question, okay? Maybe not every session, but I'm just saying, you know, especially if you're a little less free with wanting to get up and ask them yourself because you're more shy about that or whatever. So somebody else might ask it. All right, Ken.
Thank you, Rabbi. This is a question that I have about my walk, my halakha. And you brought up that word, and so I'd like to revisit James, James 1, verse 10. For whoever shall guard all of the Torah, let's see, whoever shall guard all the Torah and yet stumble on one point, he is guilty of all.
That's 2:10, yes.
2:10, yeah, I'm sorry. So I know from your teachings that I, you know, it's not upon me to decide what part of the Torah I can do or not do. That's very clear. We want to do it all, but there are times as we go through this walk, we may not know what, and then once we know, we're responsible for what we know.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
Correct.
I guess part of my question as it relates to my walk, and probably most any of us that are here, we're concerned about where is the forgiveness, where's the patience, where's the time that we have to try to work through what it is that we're going to be diligent to follow in the Torah. So
that's an interesting question because you're standing there still breathing. No, that's the patience. You laugh, but that's, I mean, you know, when you say where's the patience, you're still here. Okay? So you still have time to work this through and do what you need to do.
Okay.
That's the patience.
That may be my answer.
Yeah.
I want to make reference and see if this verse applies to this or do you need to work.
What verse?
I want to go back to, you didn't bring this up, but this is Deuteronomy 28, verse 63. And it shall be as Yahweh has rejoiced over you to do good and increase you, so does Yahweh rejoice over you to destroy you and to lay you waste, that you shall be plucked from off the land which you go to possess.
Yep.
So that is a pretty severe, to bring up what Shira was bringing, I mean, that, if you can't use that to be have fear in Yahweh, there's a verse that you can use.
Yeah, you can. Absolutely.
But I'd like to see if you can reflect on that as it applies to the fact that I'm still standing here.
Look, you know, as long as, you know, it's like those shirts you used to have that say, people said, like, be patient with me, God's not finished with me yet. Well, just know he's being patient. He's not finished with you yet as long as you're still here, okay? All right? And so that is something that you always, but now don't waste the time. Take full advantage of the time and make use of it. Because he's like, well, if I'm going to give you all this time, you're just going to waste it. What's the point? Okay, but make use of the time. He doesn't expect us to get perfect like at any particular moment. He wants us to keep wanting to be, which means you make the effort to be. And as long as you keep making the effort, you're showing your heart. And it's the heart that matters because it's the heart that's going to be in the new body, not the flesh. Okay, there you go. All right.
Thank you, Rabbi.
All right, Bill. And then live stream right after that, so you guys get ready.
Thank you, Rabbi. Just an observation. I'm just looking at the armor and how it's set up. It's all frontal.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is a metaphor. Don't turn around. Don't give your back to the enemy.
Well, there you go.
I just thought that was pretty exciting. Regarding, everybody seems to go back to the same thing I'm going to, and that's regarding partiality. And in James, it's talking about don't show disrespect towards the poor man or even towards the rich man. And he uses the verse, you shall love your neighbor as yourself.
Yep.
Is this only applying to the body, or should we be applying the same law to those who are, say, let's say, we don't agree with in government, or police officers, or county officials, or whatever else? Should we show that same sort of love them as our neighbors, as ourselves?
Well, I don't know what situations you'd be in where you'd be more in a neighbor situation, which you'd be much more in on a regular basis with the people you talked about. They're all authorities. And anybody in authority needs to be treated with the respect of that authority, because that demonstrates how you treat all authority. And so you're not to be partial about which authorities you show respect and which ones you don't. Authority is authority. Good or bad, it's still authority. And so you have to give that authority its due respect, because that shows Yahweh that you understand that it's the position that's getting the respect, not the person doing it well or badly. All right? So that would be more the thing.
So I'm just thinking that for the person, let's say I'm across the table from the county official, which I haven't been, but I'm just saying that I disagree with the person, I still show love and respect for them because that's Torah.
Well, you know, it's also smart. Yeah.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're welcome. All right, live stream.
Catherine Brown says, how are we to act towards those who have left the congregation without showing partiality?
All right. Look, it's not about partiality when it says two people walk in the congregation and you're judging them based on how they're dressed or their level of wealth. Okay, there is a difference in relationship between people that are in the body you have a certain relationship with. You also have a certain relationship with people in the world. It's a different relationship, even though they are still real relationships. There are certain cautions you have, not partialities, but cautions you have with people in the body versus how the levels of cautions you have with people outside the body. Because there are those in the body that at least conceptually are walking much more in the direction you are, at least according to what you should be expecting, compared to those that are not. And so it's not showing partiality when you are looking at something that really is different. A rich person and a poor person that want to walk this out are the same. There's nothing different about them. Someone walking this out and someone just living in the world are very different. And so it's not a partiality thing. It's using judgment and discernment that I need to be careful how I behave with one, different than I need to be careful how I behave with the other. All right? So, now, if you're going to be harsh and rude and just disrespectful to people that just because they're not in the body, that's wrong. However, if they're not in the body, they may be more potentially dangerous to your walk and derail it in some way. So you have to have a different level of caution, different sort of boundaries in how you have those relationships. So now let's talk about the people that no longer come here. Okay, those are people that you need to be aware they had reasons to leave. I'm not saying they were good ones or bad ones. I'm not saying if they even were aware what they were. Most of them never told me what they were. But they had reasons. And those reasons can be contagious. They can go viral. You can have them shared with you and you can buy into them. That's up to you what you want to do. Scripture seems to say you shouldn't even break bread with a scoffer. Most of the people that left scoffed pretty good. Okay? And so that would be a reason not to do these things. So that's not a partiality thing. That's actually a judgment based on merit, really. There's no judgment of merit about someone's level of walk and belief just because they have money or not. Right? And that's what he's saying. He says if they're poor, if they're wealthy, it doesn't change what their heart is and how their belief is when they show up to services. You can't tell just by their clothing or their bank account. However, other people you know based on their lifestyle choices or their congregational choice and things, you know that you are or are not on the same page and going in the same direction as them. So I know, for example, I've got a few friends that I'm still reasonably, I guess, friends with, hardly ever talk to each other, who are not in this walk and I've known my whole life. And so that's why I almost never talk to them because we don't have anything in common. And if I saw them, I would be very friendly. We'd shoot the breeze. We'd catch up with each other. But the relationship is different because they're not in where we are. Now, then you take somebody that left, there always is going to be this awkward thing between that because you're here and they left. Not you're here and they're somewhere else and they never were here, but they were here where you are and they chose not to be where you are. Don't just focus on how they feel about me. They didn't leave me. They left me and all of you. Okay? And you don't want to see it that way because that affects your little, but I like them and we're friends and okay, whatever. Then do what you want. I don't, you know. But I don't have any interest in relationships with any of them, although they're all welcome to come back. I said this last night. but they're going to have to talk to me and straighten out what happened and then, you know, come clean and all that other stuff, and then they can come back. And they would be treated as if they never left. I don't care. Okay? But until that happens, I'm not interested in putting my time into that kind of a space. And Yahweh says that too. He doesn't put time into the space where it's not going to bear fruit. And some of you think that you haven't heard from him in a while. Well, maybe you're not bearing any fruit. He's like, wait, he figures it's a waste of time. So he's going to let you sit until you start showing him you're not going to waste his time. Think about it. Okay? So I've never told you you can't be friends with anybody that ever went here and is not coming here anymore. You can do whatever you want. I don't really understand it, but you can do whatever you want. Okay? They rejected your leadership. They rejected you, and they rejected the congregation. They've got their reasons and excuses and everything. It doesn't matter. Ultimately, that's what it came down to. Okay? That is ultimately what it came down to. And either you, you know, are going to excuse that away because you just want the friendship so bad, or you're going to accept it for what it is. All right? Don't shun anybody. Just you may want to change the level of your relationship. How many of you had to change levels of relationship with people that you were friends with most of your life when you started doing this walk? See? Almost every hand went up. Well, people in this walk, also at some point you might need to change your level of relationship because you might realize even though they're quote-unquote in the walk, they're walking a slightly different path than you are. They keep Sabbath, but not really. They keep the feast, but not really. They keep, in other words, there are people that give lip service and do these things, and it's not really the same thing you're doing. So you need to have a little bit different level of depth of relationship with people like that because they will be potential influencers that could cause you to go where they are. Look, when two walk together, they can't walk unless they agree, which means that as long as they're walking together, eventually one will either agree with the other or they'll stop walking together. And all of you are convinced you're going to influence them, but yet more often than not, it works the other way around. Okay? The one with less of a perfect walk tends to influence the one with a better walk more often than the other way around. And you're thinking, oh, but they're off on the side. I'm gonna influence them back. No, you're going to be dragged into that world. I'm just telling you from lots of years of experience, watching people, they're all telling me, oh, I go back, I still go to my Sunday church because I'm trying to influence. No, you'll be influenced. You're not influencing anybody. Okay? The danger is more for you than the good that's going to come out of it. Now, you want to talk to those people that left? Tell them that you miss them. Tell them that you wish they were here. Tell them you wish they would fix it. Tell them Rabbi said if they would fix it, they could come back. And they would not be treated with anything except as if they never left. I will treat you just like Yahweh would treat you. Like as soon as it's fixed, it's forgotten, done, like it never happened. Okay? But they'd have to, you know, get over the ego, pride, and other emotional challenges to own what, you know, what happened. They're still blaming me for everything. It's not going to work. Okay? And that's why people leave, because they don't want to own their stuff. I'm the fault. I'm the problem. I'm this. I'm that. And that's okay. Fine. That's going to keep you out. That's going to keep you out. If I see somebody outside, I'll say hello. I won't go and seek them out, but if they seek me out, I'll say hello. I'll be friendly. I'll be polite. I'm going to be Yeshua-like as I can. And I'll sit there wondering, why did you leave and not tell me why you left? And give me a chance to help you fix whatever it was that needed to be fixed. Because they didn't. 99.99% of them never said a word. Not to me. They talked to you guys. They all got in everybody else's ear. All the Shon Hara, all yeah. Okay? And then all telling me they did it. They all told me to a person they didn't do that. Even though I had 15 people from each of them tell me that they heard this from them and that and that. But they all lied and told me they didn't say anything to anybody. Okay? Right? Elder's nodding his head. Every one of them said, oh, we never say anything about you when we're with them. But then all the people that were at those places when there was, you know, a party going on all said, oh, yeah, they were all talking about you all day long. You know. Michael just said, no cowards in the kingdom, because I said that the other night. There's no cowards in the kingdom. And it's not for lack of effort, by the way. The elder has tried hard to get people to talk to me. Because they talk real good to him, and then he says, you need to talk to Rabbi. And then when they bring him to me, guess what they do? They clam up. So, that's the end of that. Next question. I know it's hard. It's an emotional thing. You like the people when they're here. You become close to them, and then they leave. That hurts. It's hard. I was very close to some of the people that left. It hurt. Okay? Some of you know. All right, next.
Jay Jones, why does so much scripture, James 2:2 and 2:5, connect being financially poor with virtue? How are we to glean if poverty is the result of time and chance or just poor decisions and lack of wisdom?
Well, it's two different questions. Okay, so it's not so much connecting financially poor with virtue. He's saying that the poor, okay, are the ones being called because the poor will listen more readily than the wealthy because the poor realize they don't have the answers and they're in need. So they're much more readily able to receive this. Okay, I don't know if you know the bank accounts balances of most of the people in the body, but most of them are not very high. Because the wealthy are satisfied, the wealthy are happy, the wealthy or whatever they are, thinking they don't have need. The poor, and we're not supposed to stay that way necessarily, but the poor recognize, I don't have the answers, I need some help, I need to figure this out, and that's where they're willing and ready to receive. All right? And believe that something can be better. So your hope is in something better. The wealthy already think they have better. It's harder for them to get there. So it's not that it's virtuous to be poor. He's trying to say that you guys want to give all this honor and respect to the wealthy. He says he's calling the poor. The wealthy are coming too, but he's calling the poor. Elder and I can tell you, the calls we get about everybody moving here, most of them are poor. That's who's being called. So it's not that it's because it's a virtue. It's because you're more able to receive the message when you're not wealthy, okay? All right. Listen, being in ministry is a great lesson because, you know what? I have to depend on him every single day that anything's going to come in and go in the box. I mean, when we first started to when now, every day was, I mean, there were times when really we didn't know if we were going to have enough money for anything because who knew if there was going to be money in the box. When we first started, small congregation, etc. That's trusting Yah. Okay? The wealthy are already trusting themselves and their wealth on some level. Not saying that the wealthy that are in the body, I don't want to pick on you. I'm just saying is you're the exceptions because you realize there was other things in your life and other areas that he popped your bubble and he got your attention, okay? Plus, he has to get some wealthy in here or there'd be never any money to do anything. There wouldn't be any money to help the poor. So he's got to call somebody who's got a little bit of the financial stability, okay? Second part of the question was, how are we to glean if poverty is the result of time and chance or just poor decisions and lack of wisdom? Okay. 99% of the time, it's the second one. It's not time and chance. It's decisions and wisdom. Because any time and chance that makes you poor, if you make good decisions, you can be poor only for a short while, and then you're wealthy again. You take any wealthy person, take everything away from them, they will be wealthy again. Okay? Because they know how to do it. They will be wealthy again. Period. So time and chance creates temporary poverty if you're doing the better decisions and wisdom thing. It's poor decision and lack of wisdom that actually causes the most real poverty. Elder does a lot of financial training. He will tell you, most of the problems is poor decisions and lack of wisdom. Okay? We don't spend right, and we don't save right. We don't understand that our job doesn't pay enough, or we just don't have enough jobs. Elder will tell you, why don't you have 3, 4, 5 income streams? Everybody I study says the same thing. To be successful in this modern age, you need 5 income streams. I didn't say 5 jobs, 5 things that are bringing in income. Now, it could be 5 jobs, it could be anything. But you really want to have everything as safe and sound and functioning? You need more than one income stream. Most of you have one job, and that's your one income stream, and it's not enough, and it's not working. Okay? So mostly, it's poor decisions and lack of wisdom. All right, it's almost 5:30. What else you got?
Shelley Bell says, Rabbi, are works the same as doing and walking Torah / mechanics like spirit and truth? Can it be also belief in the spirit and works is truth? Can they be equal like spirit, belief, and truth and works?
All right. Yes, I guess there's some part of that that basically works. It's not the way I would maybe word it, but it's just, look, you just need to understand that your works are simply the three-dimensional expression of what's going on inside, which would be the spirit and the truth and all of that other stuff, the belief. Because remember, the spirit is the fullness of the intention of it, and the truth is the actual mechanics of it. But you're not going to do either of those without belief. So I would say, really, it's more of just understanding that all of that is manifested in the three-dimensional world as works, as evidence of what's going on inside. That would include spirit, truth, and belief. Okay? So I think I would word it differently. All right, anything else?
Just one more. Justin Rodriguez, so the helmet is a matter of defense, so our thoughts are taken captive and don't become attached to our heart or emotion and then become an action. Is this correct?
Yes, that's correct. That was easy. All right, sounds like something I actually said that he was quoting back to me. Seems I've said that many times. All right, fantastic. Okay, that's going to wrap it up for us.